AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Hi, my name is Mira Patasin. I'm an author and I'm an activist, and GoFundMe is my go-to platform for fundraising. The first GoFundMe I did was to raise money for a chapbook or a collection of poetry and essays and short stories. So we started a GoFundMe and our goal was $7,000. What I've learned is so special about GoFundMe is that it's a whole collection of people offering anything from like $4 to $400. And each time you get a ping that someone donated, even if it is just $4, it's so exciting. So if you have a goal and you get there, you can keep making it bigger and bigger and bigger. We did go past our goal. It was amazing.
GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
Social Flight is brought to you by Aspen Avionics, Avidyne, Continental Aerospace Technologies, Lightspeed Aviation, Tempest Aero Group, and Whip Air. And now, here's your host, Jeff Simon.
Welcome to Cockpit to Cal, the show that explores general aviation safety topics from the combined perspective of flight instructors, pilots, and mechanics, exploring both pilot and aircraft topics to make aviation safer and more enjoyable. I'm Jeff Simon, pilot and AMP and IA and president of Social Flight.
I'm Brian Schiff, self-certified nut and pilot and flight instructor and fatigued.
Oh man, I'll tell you, we do have a wonderful show tonight, Brian. I am really, really excited to talk about all these things having to do with autopilots. It's a huge, huge subject.
It's a huge subject. I have a lot of people I refer to as autopilot junkies, or as we've heard of, children of the magenta. And then there's a lot of that people just don't know about autopilots that you've enlightened me on and I've enlightened you on. And I can't wait to share it with other people. I don't even know what half of the other things you're going to share with us as well.
Oh, we're going to have a lot of fun tonight. But I want to start with a personal story which kind of kicked off some of this discussion on autopilots. And some of it had to do with things in the air we'll talk about a little bit later. But also, I've been having some challenges. The Bonanza that we fly here at Social Flight has a Century 3 autopilot. And I'll tell you, when that thing is working, and it has been working wonderful, it is perfect. Like, you wouldn't need anything else. It'll capture a glide slope. It'll fly holds and approaches, like anything you need it to do, it'll do, which is really impressive considering that the aircraft is from 1975. The avionics, as I've seen on the date codes on them, were built in 1974. You're talking about 51-year-old electronics. Like, try getting a toaster oven from 51 years ago to work. And it generally has been great, except now we started having some problems. And I'll tell you, I looked out there at what's involved and how much it costs to upgrade your autopilot. And it's just, you know, there are some astronomical numbers out there if you want to do kind of high-end autopilots. And to the rescue is a company called Autopilots Central. The company is owned by Alan and Susan Sparks. They're out in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And they, I'll tell you, if you can show their page. Yeah. The reason I want to put them up here isn't some like huge sponsorship thing or whatever. It is because I am passionate about how important it is to make it possible for people to keep these older autopilots working from any company. And that's what these guys are dedicated to. They do new equipment, new installations, but what they're really dedicated to that no one else I know does is keeping these old autopilots working. And they are saving the day for us at a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of what it would have cost to do a new autopilot. So I just want to say thanks that these companies exist, and that this company exists, Autopilot Central, and tell people out there, if you have a problem with your autopilot, please give them a call and check it out, because we'll talk a lot more about maintenance and operation and all the stuff you're going to teach us from the cockpit. But we've got to find a way to keep the fleet going and not just require enormous dollar, you know, multi tens of thousands of dollars. I think if you're putting in like a G600 or something in a Bonanza right now, it's like $40,000. It's insane.
Halfway across the country to have this done, didn't you?
Well, actually, they have been helping me remotely with components and servo overhauls. It's been really quite, they work with shops all over the place. It's so that you can do quite a lot without going there. So there's quite a bit you can get done. But anyway, back to regular stuff. Let's get into, tell me, I want to hear your side of, you've got some pretty profound thoughts and fundamental thoughts on autopilots. Tell me a little bit about your principles.
Well, yeah, where do I start?
Autopilot principles.
Oh, those. Okay, yeah, those are easy. Over the years, I've seen, and even myself, I have misused the autopilot, but I see other pilots misusing autopilots. Half of the ones in the flight schools, I want to talk to you about this later, they're placarded because either they don't work or they don't want to have their students to be tested on them. One less thing to include in the curriculum, or one more thing to have an expense to fix. So you see them placarded all the time. And granted, in many light airplanes, you don't necessarily need it. I did write an article that was published in Embry-Riddle's Lift magazine on automation dependency. And one of the biggest point I like to drive home, that the autopilot should be used as a tool, not as a crutch. So not something that's holding you up, not something that without it you'll fall. You need to use it as a tool for the tool that it is, and use it appropriately. So I give a lot of pointers and advice on that. I've put together some SOPs on using an autopilot, and there's a lot of things, like, for, I'm going to ask you about one of them, because one of them over the years I've heard about servos that can fail. Mm-hmm. And if it feels funny or chugging, you know, jerking and or weak, and it's not quite there, then maybe you should discontinue using it before it fails in flight and have it looked at. But I wanted to ask you about that, so hold that thought. But also, when you know, as far as using it, when you engage any mode of the autopilot, because I see this a lot, you engage, you've just asked for something. Anytime in an airplane you ask for something, make sure you get it before you move on to something else. For example, you set the flaps. Look at the flaps. Make sure they actually moved, that they came down. Look at the enunciator. But with an autopilot, if you select heading mode, make sure you got heading mode. If you selected a nav mode, make sure it went into nav or GPS so that it's actually going to track it. Because you could stay in a heading for a long time not realizing that you're not actually tracking a nav until it's, you know, becomes obvious, and then it may be too late.
Yeah.
Let me
just interject there for a second, because you brought something up that's really, really near and dear to my heart when it comes to autopilot use. And that is the idea that you set up the autopilot before you engage it. This is so, so important. I see people do this incorrectly all the time. And here's an example of what I mean by that. We live in a world with a lot of glass that you can select GPS steering, GPSS mode, for example, and whether you want it on GPS mode or you want it on heading mode. And whether or not, as you mentioned, what the nav source is that you're setting something up to, or if you're just, like we said, tracking heading or something like that. All these different things. I, more often than not, when I'm flying with another pilot who's using their autopilot, they turn on the autopilot first and then set up what it's doing, which is nuts to me. We don't fly airplanes that way, right? You don't sit there and someone says, okay, you know, it's your airplane. And the first thing they do is crank the airplane over in the 30-degree bank and then go, where do you want me to go? That's not what they do. But this is what they're doing with the autopilot. They turn the autopilot on and the plane starts turning and they look down and go, okay, I got to put it in GPSS mode and then I've got to do direct two to recenter where I'm going. Or now I've got to dial in the altitude that I want to be at, because now it's climbing. That makes no sense. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, no, it doesn't make sense. It's like, oh, you have to turn after takeoff, so let's set the ailerons into a turn before we take off and just hold them there so we don't forget to turn. No, you can't do that. And I think some people with certain kinds of autopilots might be going, huh, what are you talking about, set it? So they're not all like that. Mm-hmm. Some of them are, and if you have a flight director and an autopilot, of course, you're setting the flight director mode, and a good technique is to make sure the flight director is giving you what you want, because the autopilot is going to follow the flight director. So set that, look at it, make sure it's good, and check to make sure that you got what you want. But then just don't give up and stop there. And this is something I say so many times, and my students still have this in their heads, like when they're at the airlines, they say, well, what I would say to them is the autopilot engage switch is not a pilot disengage switch. You know what I'm saying? So that's often what happens, is I'll see people connect an autopilot, engage the autopilot, and they sit back and relax. You cannot do that. Now, maybe in cruise up high, yeah, to some extent. Down low, especially, if you engage an autopilot, you, the pilot, must still remain tactically engaged. You should have your hands on the flight controls. It's helping you, at least initially. Anytime you engage or disengage the autopilot, your hands should be on the flight controls. When you engage it, then check to make sure you got what you want and make sure that it doesn't start doing something it shouldn't do. But be ready, and your mind should mentally be engaged in the flight as well. So many pilots will check out, you know, once they get the autopilot checked on. And you can't do that. You just don't know what they're going to do. You just never know. They're a mechanical thing without a brain. Yeah. They have computers and all that, and some of them are smarter than some people, and arguably me. But you got to keep an eye on it. In fact, I was going to share just the article that I've got. You're going to get it in the email that you get, the 1 hour prior and then the 1 hour, you know, after the show tomorrow. Thanks for joining. You'll get a link to this, to download this article. This is one that I had published, and I think it's a good one, but I'm biased. And it's also on my website. You can just go to captainshift.com and click on that. You'll see it. So I encourage you to read that as the course materials for tonight. But, another guy that taught me initially how to use autopilots used to say, watch it like you would an open cash drawer. Would you turn your back on an open cash drawer in public? No, that autopilot is the cash, and you want to watch it. Make sure it doesn't go away.
Yeah, I think it's something that gets added to your scan.
That's
the way I think about it. Like, your engine is always in your scan, like your instruments, you're always, especially if we're talking about, you know, flying IMC or something, but it's always in your scan. And therefore you have to know what's happening and be prepared at any time, because there are things that can cause it to kick off, et cetera. Let's kind of take this in sort of a story fashion and go back to the beginning and think about this in terms of starting on the ground. And to me, one of the things I find interesting is that I don't routinely see people including their autopilot in their pre-flight, in their actual, not, I mean, I'm not saying the ground part, I'm saying the, you know, the run-up part, essentially, your avionics check. And yet this is part in that aircraft flight manual supplement. There are pre-flight tasks you are supposed to do with your autopilot.
And in flight reviews, I'll quite often see people not do the pre-flight. And I say, no, if that's operative, I want to see you go through the pre-flight on that autopilot, because I know you plan on using it. There are a lot of people mentioning about my mic being so much louder than yours. Just real quick, I turned it down, and could someone just post in the chat if this is better? I turned mine down. I think it's because mine is too loud, not that Jeff's is too quiet. But anyway, I was just noticing that, and I don't want to...
I will speak loudly. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the ground checks and even things that can have to do with maintenance, et cetera.
Yeah.
So when you're on the ground, you have the ability of putting an autopilot usually into roll mode, into some other things, and observing what happens with the control surfaces, which is very, very important. And this is incredibly, especially important if it's post-maintenance. There are a lot of things that can affect autopilot engagement that have to do with maintenance. even if the autopilot has not been something that's been worked on, or if your avionics have not been something that's been worked on. However, if your avionics have been worked on, then that actual ground check is even more critical than you might imagine. One of the things I find interesting, I've looked at, like, for example, on the Sentry manual, on their installation manual, they literally have things that say, you know, wire up a servo, and then the way you know if it's working correctly is to test it. And then it literally says, if it works in the opposite direction, reverse the leads and try again. That's how these were built. Literally, try it. They're not labeled A, B that way. It was like, try it, make sure it works in the right direction. If it doesn't, reverse it. These are things that a good avionics shop, no question that they'll do, but you still need to be careful.
Yeah. I think that that probably would save time rather than like following the wiring and making sure you do it all right. And it's probably more reliable to just put two wires in, check them. If they're backwards, switch them back. It's more reliable and faster method probably. But as you say, every flight, if you're going to use your autopilot, yes, engage the heading, go left and right. The yoke should turn left and should turn right. If you see it go backwards, which actually I should say control wheel, it's not a yoke, but because someone's going to correct me on that later. But you want to see it pitch forward, pitch back when you roll it up, nose down. And most importantly, can you disconnect it? What if that disconnect switch isn't?
Hi, my name is Mira Patasin. I'm an author and I'm an activist, and GoFundMe is my go-to platform for fundraising. The first GoFundMe I did was to raise money for a chapbook or a collection of poetry and essays and short stories. So we started a GoFundMe and our goal was $7,000. What I've learned is so special about GoFundMe is that it's a whole collection of people offering anything from like $4 to $400. And each time you get a ping that someone donated, even if it is just $4, it's so exciting. So if you have a goal and you get there, you can keep making it bigger and bigger and bigger. We did go past our goal. It was amazing.
GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
Working. That's been a problem, too, that's caused some issues. Be familiar with all of the ways to disconnect the autopilot. And pre-flight, even if your autopilot doesn't say to check that, I encourage you to, if the trim wheel will disconnect it, I want to be darn sure that the trim, electric trim switch does disconnect the autopilot, re-engage it, check the push to disconnect button, make sure that disconnects it. Push the button on the control head, make sure that disconnects it. Whatever ways, and maybe overpowering it. Some pre-flights require you to overpower before you disconnect.
Here's some examples of things, as long as we're in that kind of scenario where we're talking about the ground here. I'll go back to the point I made earlier about maintenance, for example. One of the things that's common, especially for, I'm focusing slightly on older autopilots for the moment, because there's so many out there, is that a lot of people will go and get replacement things. Like they'll get a servo that's a replacement, and they'll, and your mechanic can do that. They don't need an avionics shop. However, it isn't just that wiring we talked about, like follow the manual. When you go and you get things like replacement servos, and I have experienced this firsthand, different servos you'll get are wired differently. And you may take a regular plug and put it in and think, I'm ready to go, and find the servo operates backwards.
Oh my gosh, because so the same part?
The same part. That's why Sentry created the thing that has that says test it and reverse the leads if you need to.
Makes sense.
It's just because part number can go into a variety of things, can be wired in different ways. So that's really important. Another thing about that ground test that I have experienced firsthand and is so important is you mentioned trim. Now, knowing that your electric trim is working properly on the ground is absolutely critical. And I had an example once where I was flying along and the aircraft all of a sudden had a very violent pitch over on autopilot in IMC. Was flying along and literally all of a sudden everyone's head hits the ceiling and the plane just pitches over. And what happened was that the when one of the switches was being set early on in the, or on the ground, or maybe getting out of the airplane in a previous flight, the electric trim switch got flipped off. It was very easy to hit.
Oh, no. I do that sometimes, the autopilot, but that's a different story.
So the trim switch got flipped off. Well, what that means is that your autopilot, in this case, your regular elevator, your pitch servo, is fighting against trim during the flight, and it's building up those forces. And usually an autopilot that includes trim control would be adjusting trim along with that and reducing the forces on the roll. On the pitch. Well, the pitch servo was building up and building up and building up the force until it hit its clutch breakout point. And as soon as it hit the clutch breakout point with no trim, fighting trim, these autopilots know they hit that. They say goodbye. They're like, hey, thanks. It's your job now. And the plane pitches. Yeah.
Well, and if they don't say goodbye, that's another reason that one of my techniques is anytime you disengage, grab the wheel.
Yeah.
You know, and hold it in position. Mm-hmm. Hold the flight controls in position when you disconnect the autopilot.
Because you don't know the trim situation.
You don't know the trim situation. And I learned that, yes, from a 727, but also in small airplanes, same thing. When you disconnect, if it's not in trim, or if it may have been fighting some issue that your trim was in op and it's way out of trim, but it's enough to not disconnect the autopilot, but enough to take you by surprise for sure. Yes.
And another great thing about doing that is you can discover that you actually do have an issue you have to address maintenance-wise, because it should be automatically trimming out, and if in an aircraft with electric trim, et cetera. Obviously, lots of caveats here. But if it is not doing that, that's something you need to address, and you don't want to just find it out another way.
That's true. Yeah.
So there we are on the ground. Brian, take me to the next step of kind of like takeoff and some of the things that you see people doing with autopilots.
Well, one of the things, so the pre-flight is obviously a big one. And one of we have a very dignified audience, I must say, because one of our dignified guests mentioned something about the Aztec autopilot pre-flight being 27 steps long. And that is very discouraging for some people, but what it does is it spells out a lot of things that like five steps might be something that if you understand what you're doing and the whole process of what you're doing it, why you're doing it, it takes you, five steps might take a second. And so what I recommend, rather than reading that whole checklist, is know what you're doing, understand what you're doing, and treat it like a flow. Like, okay, autopilot on, left heading, right heading, it says, and just go through the whole thing, and you realize, oh, the whole thing is really 10 seconds. But to teach it to you, it's a 27-step checklist. Many checklists are like that, and I don't like it. So you can kind of make your own and say, check heading, check pitch. And that might take the place of 10 steps, but you know what you need to do on each of those. So after that, so now you're going to go flying, you're going to get in there. First of all, you want to make sure it's disengaged for takeoff. In some airplanes, it should be turned off for takeoff because you don't want it interfering or doing something down low to the ground that you're unexpected. One thing that I see a lot of people do is engage it a little lower than I would engage it, or even lower than what the manual limitation says, do not engage below a certain altitude. And I don't like to see people, I would double that. Fly this airplane. You want to make sure this thing's flying well. I mean, down low to the ground, I trust a pilot more than I do an autopilot. So fly it and get it engaged a little bit later. So don't engage it too early. Once you do engage the autopilot, hold it firmly, set the modes that you want, and then engage the autopilot, make sure that the modes are there in the mode control panel or the enunciator panel, and that it is what you set. So you got what you asked for sure. Then gingerly let go, but be ready to grab it again. Don't just let go and go do something else.
Have been some very key accidents that involved autopilots that you can read up on. And they are cases where people engage the autopilot. There was one not far away from here that happened where the autopilot was engaged at 200 feet AGL and on a climb out. And I feel like there's an issue where some people feel uncomfortable in IMC, even though they are IFR rated pilots, and they feel that they would rather have the autopilot enter the clouds than themselves enter the clouds and make that transition. And that kind of scares me. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that scares me too. I don't, like I said, that's what I referred to at the very beginning, is using the autopilot like a crutch, not like a tool. You shouldn't be that busy. Everything that needs to be done down low, you should have ready to go, have set in advance. Granted, some things could happen, but you should be hand flying that airplane. If you're not comfortable flying IMC, don't let the autopilot be the reason it's okay to go into IMC. So don't use it as a crutch. If you be just as comfortable hand flying in IMC as you are using the autopilot in IMC, because if it disengages you or won't engage or fails or whatever reason you need to hand fly the airplane, you need to be ready for that. And so I don't like seeing it be used as a crutch. Definitely get out and practice some IMC if you're not comfortable flying in IMC. It's a lot different than a simulator. It's a lot different than a hood work. When you're flying and doing hood work, you know, you can just look up and peek if you had. When you're shrouded by clouds, it is a lot different than a hood or a simulator, because there's a lot more at stake. And, you know, this stuff is real, you know?
Yeah.
So
take
getting up
through
to
that a little bit, Brian, like from your perspective as a commercial pilot and as a flight instructor, help me with what you teach or what you tell people who are making that transition into IMC on how to fly the aircraft for that very initial departure, and where it's comfortable and legal and safe to then transition to the autopilot.
Yeah. So first of all, get training. Don't do it yourself. If you've got your instrument rating and never flown in the clouds, don't do it for the first time by yourself. Find an instructor, go try to get some IMC training, or if you haven't done it yet and your only choice is to go IMC, I recommend that you do not do it. It's a different world. Yes, you would be legal, but I don't think it's safe. So the first thing I teach you, when you transition to the clouds, you're looking visually out the window, and it's very tempting to continue to do so. Departing into IMC, you need to get down on the instruments right away. As soon as that airplane is off the ground, anything you see is going to be misleading out the window. You want to get right on your instruments. First of all, back it up. Pre-flight those instruments while you're taxiing out, so you have confidence that they're going to work. You know, make sure the DG is turning, or your heading indicator is turning the right way, that your ball is centered, the attitude is what it should be, and doesn't bank when you turn the aircraft on level ground. Make sure that you have confidence in your flight instruments. Get in the air, use them and trust them, and do not go by what you see out the window. You could have a tilted cloud deck above or below you. In the clouds, sometimes there'll be thicker parts and you'll see things coming, and don't be tempted to look out the window and go, ooh, pretty, look at those clouds going by. That's really cool. And everybody wants to do that, even me. Get on the instruments and trust them and play the video game that it is. Put the airplane where you know it should be to get what you want out of it. So that's the important thing, is knowing where to put the airplane to get what you want out of it. That's one of the things that my students who are at the airlines now still say they hear in their heads when they go IMC. Put the airplane where you know it should be, you know, 172, nose on the horizon, clean, 2100 RPM, I'm going to get 90 knots straight and level. You know some basic pitch and power settings for your airplane. I'd hate to fly by the numbers, but those are targets that are really good. So when you fly your airplane in the Bonanza, you know that when you power back, there's a certain, you know, after takeoff, do it slowly. And do it, if you're going into IMC, do it a little higher than you normally would. I mean, you can go for, 5 minutes? Whatever the limit is, don't do it right at 200 or 300 feet in IMC, because that's one of the most common times, and correct me if I'm wrong as a mechanic, when engines fail is when you're making a change.
Yes, 100%.
Good, because I've been teaching that. So I'm glad to hear that I'm, you know, I haven't been full of it in that respect. But
you're absolutely right. I do want to point out, you said something that really resonated with me earlier, and that is that idea of in most every case for a GA pilot, there is a certain amount of visual conditions before you enter the cloud. Mm-hmm. And the idea that you should be on the instruments during that phase. And I think for me, you are a far more experienced, far higher time pilot for IMC flying than I am. For me, I find that period of time, as short as it may be, as if I'm on instruments during that time after rotation and at the beginning of that climb, my peripheral vision, where there's still visual cues, that's my comfort zone that focuses me on the instruments and makes my you know, primitive brain confident.
So like, I'm not sure what you're saying about the peripheral vision.
Well, I guess in those first like few hundred feet or whatever it is that you have, you sort of know I'm still right side up and I'm looking at the instruments. Like you've said, let's transition to instruments. And there is something about making the transition there instead of having your head up and seeing yourself enter the clouds and then going down. And now your primitive brain has to trust the instrument.
Right. Yeah.
I'm saying I kind of build that trust subliminally, subconsciously.
Okay.
By being on the instrument first.
I get that. As long as you're looking at something that you know is true.
I'm only looking at the instruments. And I'm just
I mean, before you go in with your peripheral, there might be a cloud deck that's slanted, you know, and you don't want to be using that as something.
No, not at all.
Yeah, look at the runway lights. But I recommend if you're about to go in the soup, if you got 500 overcast, as soon as you rotate and you've confirmed that you're going straight after liftoff by looking at the runway, the centerline lights, if you have them, but look at the runway lights or the runway markings. As soon as you get off and get in the air and you know you're going to go on MC, get on the instruments then. That's exactly what I teach.
Yeah. That's exactly what I'm saying. I'm saying that if you transition to instruments right away, as you've recommended, then there's just something subconscious, knowing that you're still in clear air, that makes you feel even more comfortable staying on it and being confident in it.
Right. Right. And I think that, you know, I don't know what we're going to find out about that Lear crash in Pennsylvania. It's just awful. But I flew the Learjet, and I don't know if that was engaging the yaw damper at that time, and they got a hard over or something at the really worst time. I would just make sure that any time you go to engage something else that's going to grab the flight controls from you, that you're in a position to have them do the wrong thing and be ready to disconnect. I have my thumb on the disconnects when I'm engaging an autopilot. I'm always ready to do it because you don't have a lot of time to recover from something that's really bad if the autopilot servos just kick in and go full bore. So,
I mean, it's the equivalent to just cranking, you know, the yoke or your stick. It's a pretty big deal.
It's pretty aggressive. Yeah, it is aggressive. So if you don't have a yaw damper, also the yaw dampers are very nice when you disconnect. But if you don't have one, I recommend, you know, I've told before, push on both pedals during turbulence to try to stop the yawing.
Hi, my name is Mira Patasan. I'm an author and I'm an activist. And GoFundMe is my go-to platform for fundraising. The first GoFundMe I did was to raise money for a chapbook or a collection of poetry and essays and short stories. So we started a GoFundMe and our goal was $7,000. What I've learned is so special about GoFundMe is that it's a whole collection of people offering anything from like $4 to $400. And each time you get a ping that someone donated, even if it is just $4, it's so exciting. So if you have a goal and you get there, you can keep making it bigger and bigger and bigger. We did go past our goal. It was amazing.
GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
You can kind of have a built-in yaw damper just by pushing on the rudder to stop the rudder from kind of going along with the turbulence. Another thing I see that I don't like is like if you're going into the clouds and yes, you're certified for icing, great, good for you, get into the icing, but then don't use the autopilot when you're climbing through an icing level. You want to know what's happening. You want to feel the airplane. You want to feel it flutter. You want to feel the loss of performance, something that the autopilot might just constantly be slowly trimming the airplane because you're losing lift. It's pitching up, it's trimming, and you wouldn't know that. So hand fly during icing conditions. That's another thing that I like to teach. But also using the appropriate level of automation. If you're just flying a heading, you know, don't program your computer to do headings and courses and use the appropriate level of automation. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a bit. But so do that. But when you level off, I've seen pilots. So now you're getting up to cruise. You level off. I've seen pilots just keep the airplane in the normal climb configuration. And as soon as they get to cruise altitude, boom, autopilot on altitude hold. And now the airplane's overshoots. It's coming back and bad technique. No way. Yeah, bad technique. So don't do that. Level off. trim the airplane, then engage the autopilot. And one real quick thing, occasionally and frequently, maybe every 10, 20 minutes, disengage the autopilot, make sure it's still in trim, retrim the airplane. You might have had a CG shift from people moving from one seat to another, or from burning fuel or whatever, or just different winds. You may be in a different kind of a downdraft and the thing had to change and change pitch and trim. So disconnect, retrim, reconnect. You'll save fuel, minusculely, but you will save fuel. And it's not as hard on the autopilot.
That is even more important now with some of the lower cost autopilots that are out on the market that are now coming out, which is great that they're out there. I absolutely love them. We're putting a trio in the Mustang right here behind me.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you, that is a big deal in doing that. You need, they don't have, we certainly haven't installed auto trim in that, and many aircraft out there don't have that as part of their autopilot. And so therefore, it's incumbent upon the pilot to ensure the aircraft is in trim and you're not putting excessive workloads on the pitch servo when it's doing
that. Yeah, right, exactly.
And the same concept is true if you're like, it's almost like thinking, well, I'm just going to stick it into roll mode and a heading mode or something like that. And I don't have to worry about balancing the fuel tanks. I don't have to worry about, trimming aileron trim or anything. You do. You really do.
Yeah, I agree. Things change. Flights are dynamic. And you wouldn't sit there and hold a lot of back pressure for 2 hours, would you? Your muscles would fatigue. So the autopilot parts do too. I also, like I said before, I want to reiterate, practice flying IMC. If it's just a straight and level cruise, fly straight and level. It will improve your scan just flying straight and level, because the airplane will wander a little bit and you've got to keep working it. It engages you with the aircraft during that phase of flight, and it gives you great practice. So I recommend doing that. But when you level off, whether you're IMC or VMC or just VFR, one technique I like pilots to use is to be sterile cockpit the last 500 feet before level off, whether it's climb or descent. Just a technique, and then watch out for altitude and hold. Make sure it's engaged. There may be different autopilots might kind of start the capture process, and maybe you pull power back too soon, which is another don't do. And maybe you never locked on the altitude hold, and it's just trying to capture, but it's not, and you might get it fishing around. Verify.
There's one item I really want to talk to you about some now and get your thoughts on, and that is one thing that I've noticed that I think needs more attention in general from people flying with autopilots is the idea that, you as a pilot do a lot of things with navigation of the aircraft that maybe you don't give yourself credit for. That you will set up a course, let's say, or be flying an approach or doing whatever it is that you're doing. And if your navigation system doesn't necessarily sequence to something, or if you think you're supposed to be turning to capture a course in a certain way, you're going to just do it. And if your avionics don't properly sequence, you're going to fly the aircraft the correct way. You certainly should.
Yeah.
And then you're going to figure out your avionics second. And the reality is that when you're engaged in that autopilot, it works exactly the opposite. It is only going to fly what it actually is programmed for and what your avionics actually do. And if they don't properly sequence and capture a final approach course, or if they have you fly over it in a different way, you're going to go, I don't know what's happening with this and why this line didn't turn magenta, or why nothing changed, but I'm flying the needles, or I'm flying this course, and you're going to do it properly. Well, the autopilot can't. It can only do what it's given. And there was a really interesting article that I had read, a part of AOPA recently, that was, for example, distinguishing between flyover waypoints and flyby waypoints.
Yeah.
And talking about how the way that someone had set up an approach, they were coming in and they thought they would be carving this nice curve and just capturing it, but that's not what the autopilot did. The autopilot went right over the point through the localizer and then turned back around and captured it the other way. Well, it was because of the way that they had chosen to trim off a hold and when they were navigating. And it was a fly over. They left a flyover waypoint instead of a flyby waypoint.
Yeah, holding pattern. You're supposed to fly over it and then start the turn.
Well, it was the way they trimmed it. Like, it was legal. You were allowed to trim it off. You were allowed to take that curve in.
Yeah.
But they deleted whatever it was. They deleted the wrong piece of the sequence.
Yeah, circles fixes you've got to fly right over, then start your turn. But most of the time, the aim actually says you can lead a turn before a fix if it's right. A lot of degrees of heading change or course change. You could lead that turn ahead. Just you want to stay within the 4 mile.
Right.
And
so in this case, with this article, what was interesting is it was legal to lead the turn. It was legal to join that way, but that's not what happened. And the autopilot blew right through it, cranked around, and it puts you in that situation that basically our whole show is about, where you're flying and it's like, uh-oh, what is it doing? And you don't know the answer.
Yeah, that's funny, because I was just going to get to that next when... You know, I fly the Airbus, right? I fly the A321. And what is one of the most common questions we hear in the Airbus? What's it doing now? And the experienced pilots will always say, there it goes again. But they're not totally 100% reliable. But one thing is, they are reliable. They will do what you ask them to. And if you ask them to do the wrong thing, they will dutifully comply with that. And so I have some SOPs that I like to do to keep myself from programming the autopilot incorrectly, and I'll share those in a second. In fact, I've got my SOPs as a cheat sheet, Cliff's Notes type thing, Shift's Notes. I'll share that. That's also on my website. But I want to go through some of those toward the end of this. But one of the things that, if you have to ask yourself, what's it doing now? And you know what it should be doing. You know you need to be wings level and not descending or climbing. That's time for click, 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 disengage everything, hand fly the airplane, get everything where it should be. This is where I say use the appropriate level of automation. And this is something you can Google a video on YouTube from an old airline training video called Children of the Magenta. And that's, if you look for that on YouTube, you'll find it. And Children of the Magenta. But he talks about the appropriate level of automation. And when you're asking yourself, what's it doing now? What is it doing? That's the time to click it off. Don't try to figure out what it's doing. Hand fly at that point and fly that thing, like do that pilot stuff. Do what you know you should be doing with the airplane. Then try and re-engage the, put it back together one at a time at the appropriate time. And then you can see, is it doing what I'm asking or not?
Yeah. Yeah. That's an excellent, excellent point. I'd like to hear those if you want to get to show us those points.
Yeah. I'll go through those. So I'll just show you a picture of it, but then we'll talk about them. So this is my Cliff's Notes, my Shift's Notes, and I have them on all kinds of different topics, and they're on my website. But these are the ones. In fact, I guess I could leave it up here, but we can go through them. Always keep your heading bug synced with the, I can't do it like this. So if you want to get these, you can go to my website and download them. But my screen looks funny if I'm sharing, so we'll go through them. But if you always keep your heading bug synchronized with what you're flying or the heading that you're on, it keeps you engaged. It also keeps you ready to accept radar vectors. If they say 10 left, you're ready to just grab and go 10 left. It will also help you recognize a compass failure. If you keep the heading bugs, so that used to say in the 767, keep the brick over the sailboat or something like that, because of the heading bug and the sailboat. So keep it synced. And if you find that you're having to keep change it to keep it synced, then maybe your heading's drifting. Something to watch out for.
Yeah.
Monitor your vertical speed. If you're IFR, make sure that you report. If it's a mandatory report, if you can't maintain 500 feet per minute, that's the minimum for IFR flying. For VFR, monitor it, because it may be changing in a way that it'll keep you engaged if you monitor vertical speed. That's one of the SOPs that I teach. I can get into that a whole other lesson. But another thing is, use a shallow climb or descent rate prior to level off. Don't ask the autopilot to do something you wouldn't want to do. You know, the rule of thumb is 10% of your rate of climb. If you're climbing 500 feet a minute, then 50 feet early, reduce the rate of climb before it captures, or wherever you think it's going to capture, just shallow out the climb or descent. Don't let it have to do some fancy footwork as the autopilot. Don't ask too much of it before level off. Then again, after you level off, if you have a capture, auto capture, like let's say your autopilot will capture an altitude, you've stabilized, it's in trim, you think it's in trim, that's a good time to just disconnect, trim everything, and I mentioned that earlier, and then reconnect. So you should be able to go hands off and then re-engage the autopilot. And now you know that autopilot and those servos aren't working very hard because you've got in trim. Another thing that I like to teach with the autopilot is certain triggers. And the triggers are something that when this happens, you do that. So one of them is when you are told fly heading such and such, that means sync the heading bug. Hopefully it was already synced, but then move the heading bug, engage heading mode. That's when you, whenever you hear the term fly this heading, obviously it sounds obvious, but these are kind of, if you think of them as triggers, they're kind of like, okay, this means do that. If you're told and you're being vectored for an approach and they say intercept the localizer or the final approach course, it doesn't mean, it's not the same thing as clear for the approach. And I've seen people arm approach when they're cleared to just intercept the localizer. All that means is you can fly that final approach course. You cannot descend, you're not clear for the approach. So if you hear the term intercept localizer, that means arm the lateral mode only, arm localizer or nav, but don't arm approach. But when you hear the words cleared for the approach, now that's a trigger for arm the whole approach. You want to hit the approach mode, hit the nav, ILS, approach, whatever you've got to hit to get the thing coupled up for the full approach. So again, cleared for the approach means that's when you hit arm the approach. I see a lot of people do it early, and it's kind of a setup for failure because the airplane might start down before you're actually cleared for the approach, and that may not be ATC's intent. And I got a bunch more triggers too. But another technique for SOPs, I like read the mode changes aloud. If you're going heading, say heading, and then so say it and then do it. It's kind of like, you know, when an emergency happens, first you do it, then you say it. But say the mode change, okay, heading, and then hit it, and then say heading, kind of like a checklist response. It's just a good technique. You're talking to yourself, but you're bringing your voice as like a third party to the whole crew. Good for single pilot operations. Scan your dance card, your mode enunciator. Look at what modes you're in often. Keep that as part of your scan. Make sure that the autopilot, like you said earlier, is engaged, and keep that as part of your instrument scan. Every so many minutes, you should check your engine gauges. Every system on the airplane should be checked periodically. Include the autopilot connect and the modes as part of that scan. Using vertical speed during a climb. This is somewhere where I want a pilot to stay engaged. I see this a lot, and I don't have a problem using vertical speed during climb. What I do have a problem with is when a pilot engages vertical speed and then goes and does something else. Now you set, for example, you're flying your Bonanza and you said, I want you level in 2 minutes. So you set 1500 feet a minute climb. They wanted you through 2000 feet above you in 2 minutes or whatever. You set 1500 feet a minute and you look down and you start doing something else, you get distracted. You know what's gonna happen in your Bonanza if you leave 1500 feet a minute without tending to it, right?
Yeah, we'll be spinning out of the clouds within a certain amount of time, yeah.
Right, so I'm okay with using it, but just stay engaged, stay on it, like you're flying. I mean, when you're flying and if you see the vertical speed going and your airspeed dropping, you're gonna lower the nose. Well, yeah. If you have the autopilot flying at vertical speed, stay engaged with it so that you can select a lower vertical speed if your airspeed starts dropping off.
Yeah.
Lastly, whenever you're disconnecting the autopilot, hold the flight controls tightly in position, like where they are. Don't hold it with like a wet noodle. Don't just put your fingers on it and relax, disengage the autopilot, and you want to be holding it tightly. So that's the last one.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I do is I view even normal navigation with an autopilot engaged in the same way that I view switching fuel tanks. When I go to switch fuel tanks and I'm flying along, I consider that to be a critical moment of flight. I announce it. I make sure everybody on board understands that, because I want them to know that if the engine stumbles, this is why. And I'll just either make sure it's not a momentary thing or I'll switch back to another tank. And to me, that's a very critical moment. Yeah. I do the same thing with the autopilot. Anytime that I'm coming up to a point that has any, what I would consider to be a significant course change, especially if you're IMC, but even in visual conditions, because, you know, you're sitting there, you're on a long trip, perhaps people are chatting, all these things are happening. Autopilots, they generally fly a little bit more like either precise or sometimes more aggressive than you might fly yourself. And all of a sudden you're going to come over that point or up to the point that there's a curve, you know, for a lead in, and all of a sudden it's just going to start banking. Well, if you've got a significant point in your route that's going to happen, everyone should know that's going to happen. You should know that's going to happen.
Yeah.
And you should watch it and make sure it actually happens the way you intended it to. And the same is especially true if you're dealing with an approach and it's going to involve a pitch.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think announcing it increases your situational awareness. But even if they're just passengers, increasing their situational awareness is also good, because what if the autopilot does something in a way you wouldn't have done and it scares them, but you know, oh, that was the autopilot, that wasn't me. So at least you've got someone else to blame if you told them, hey, the autopilot's about to do this. So yeah, I agree with that. Yeah.
I want to talk about a few maintenance things as well in the remaining, with some of the remaining time that we have here.
Sure.
Because let's start with one thing, and that is, you mentioned one of my personal pet peeves, and that is like in-op autopilots. I hate that. Every flight school airplane, every rental airplane I ever had when I was coming up, before I owned my own, had an in-op autopilot. And it's such a shame, because there's this idea for some reason that getting an autopilot working is too much hassle or not worth it, or it's just going to be a money pit. It doesn't have to be that way. It really doesn't. And I think having an autopilot and teaching students how to learn an autopilot, how to use an autopilot, not so much that it's so important that the Flight School 172's autopilot's working for convenience, but as a training tool, is really, really important, and as a rental fleet. And so I wish that people would invest more in doing that. I did mention, obviously, Autopilot Central at the beginning of the show, but regardless of who you use, it's generally possible to keep these older autopilots going. And especially right now, at this time, even though they're so old, so many people have upgraded that there is actually a plethora of used avionics and used components on the market that you should not just buy off eBay and stick in your plane, but that can be purchased and then have checked and yellow tagged by a certified facility, that it's not like we can't find these parts. You can.
What does yellow tagged mean? You take it for granted. I don't know what that means.
Well, it means that a certified repair station, in most cases, sometimes it can be done by other places, but in most cases, it's a certified repair station that has the manual and knows how to go and take something and test it. A servo is a perfect example, right? They take the servo and they know exactly what the specs are. This is how much voltage it should require before the motor starts turning. This is exactly what the breakout force should be for the clutch in it. Like things like that. And they test it. They put it on a stand. And once it passes that, they put a yellow tag that's serviceable on it. Now, you'll often see that it said working as removed.
As removed?
Yes. So if you go and you look at used parts, any part, we're talking about autopilot parts, but anything that's out there, one of the most common things you'll find, especially on eBay and other places like that, is the idea that we took this thing out. Maybe it was a wreck. Maybe it was a totaling of an aircraft. Maybe it was removed to upgrade this component. And mechanics will do it, and they'll grab a yellow tag. Now, the reason that you have tags that are yellow, like for serviceable, you have tags for red that they put on parts that are not serviceable. They should be scrapped. So this is a color coding system used in maintenance, and you've got, you know, green tags and things like that. And it's really important that you do not just trust a component because someone wrote on it working as removed. That means nothing. You don't really know it was working as it was.
I don't even understand that language, working as removed.
It means at the time they removed it, no one had complained. Like, that's what it means.
I see.
It's like you could part out pieces of an engine. It's like someone could say, I upgraded to a power flow exhaust system. And someone said, oh, well, we're going to sell yours. And so the mechanic puts a tag on it. And they're just like, hey, you know, we didn't know of any problem with this when it was removed. So this was working as, and they sell it, whatever. Well, it doesn't mean it was actually inspected carefully. And so it's really important if you're going to do that, especially with an autopilot component, that you have it tested. It's not that expensive to have someone test a component and make sure. Other thing is to make sure you're actually doing this on your own aircraft. And that is not you as an individual, but you know, a lot of people complain that their autopilots don't work properly. They swim a lot, they don't capture, they're vague in their response. And these are in most cases easily solvable issues. It all starts with the aircraft. And so the first thing you do is you make sure, having nothing to do with your autopilot, is your aircraft in rig?
Yeah.
Are your controls and your trim and everything lubricated and moving freely? So if, is there excessive play in any of your hinges or any of the linkages or anything else? Are your cables have the right tension that are throughout the aircraft? Like, everything there has to be right before you layer an autopilot on top of it. Because as a human...
That's why I have to swim when I'm holding and heading. It must not be me.
It's not you. It's the aircraft.
The rigging or the friction or the lubing. That's what it is. Because my co-pilots or my students are like, I thought you can't even hold a heading. I'm like, yeah, it's not rigged.
Yes, yeah. And so, there's a big difference between, and someone mentioned there, there's a big difference between having, real 8130, forms and things that you get when you have a part that is been looked at by a repair station that knows what they're doing versus a tag. And, so first the aircraft's got to be itself in exactly the condition that it should be. Because as a pilot, as you mentioned, you may overcome these things. You may think, hey, that Warrior's got the trim is kind of stiff or whatever. And you kind of don't notice this stuff. But on the autopilot side, it's very, very important. And so first you have to do that. And then the second is you can actually have someone test your servos and see if they are meeting those standards of turning at the right.
Some of those I just write off as being, this is a lousy autopilot. And like you said, I should probably be writing it up and saying this needs to be fixed. Sometimes I just say, oh, this is a horrible autopilot, and I don't complain because it's easier just to not complain. But what are some signs that a pilot should look for? Like I said, in the pre-flight, when you see it ratcheting, I remember the old KFC 150s they'd ratchet quite a bit sometimes. Like is that a sign that something's going wrong if you change the heading and it's ratcheting when it turns?
I mean, a smooth autopilot should not be generally doing that. So I'd say things generally need to be checked out, but I'm not an expert in that autopilot.
Yeah, I always thought that was because they had a reputation of, the servo going bad. And I thought that maybe that's a precursor to that. Speaking of precursor, I wanted to go off topic and ask you a question on something else, like talking about symptoms you should be aware of.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, so two nights from now, we're doing the third episode of the Shift Show, and we're talking about handling emergencies. And I had an engine failure one time, partial power loss, and I called you afterwards and I remember telling you about it. And it turns out it was a valve, one of the cylinders threw a valve, and you said that shouldn't happen. These are all preventable. And I want to have a section in Thursday night's program about what you can do to prevent an accident or an emergency by simply being aware of and watching and paying attention to your airplane's symptoms that are giving you. So I remember you gave me something. You said, okay, that valve shouldn't just fail. There's some symptoms you can see that you should say something about and not go fly. I don't remember it.
Sure. So in your case, you're talking about a Lycoming engine for your aircraft.
Right.
You experienced a valve failure.
Well, this was in a 172, yeah.
Yep.
A valve failure, yeah, Lycoming.
So for Lycoming engines, Lycoming and Continental each have their own kind of, sort of vulnerabilities, I guess, when things do start to fail. In Continentals, they tend to sort of burn valves a little bit more if they're not rotating properly. And for that case, you look for heat signatures to make sure that you catch something long before a problem happens. But on your aircraft and on Lycoming engines, one of the things that really should not happen anymore, we know enough that this should not happen, is this idea of having valve failures with a valve stick in place where they can't move through smoothly through the guide, and they jam. And essentially with a valve, they have a spring that's pulling them back in, and you're pushing it out and the spring is closing the valve.
Right.
And when that valve stem gets coked up basically with contaminants and exhaust gases, it starts to stick. And what will happen in the early stages of this is it will get something where when you first start the engine and it's cold and the tolerances are different inside the engine, you will start to get slightly rough running, which is in the industry kind of called morning sickness. And and so people who say, my engine's a little rough and once it warms up, it's fine. I go, whoa, time out. Like, there's a check for Lycoming engines called Service Bulletin 388C, and it is called the valve wobble check. It is not hard to do, and a shop can test that clearance and see if that valve is starting to stick. And if it is, there is an easy procedure to ream it out. There's not much easy you can do if it's too big, but if it's too tight, there's a procedure to make it and check it. And I personally think that that should be done on a regular basis. And also, of course, anytime you see a symptom. If you catch this, you will not have a sticking valve. It should not, at least, ever
happen. Well, that's good. Yeah, that's exactly what I'm looking for. So, because I would ignore the morning sickness you're talking about. I would be like, oh, give a little more gas, pick up the speed, increase the RPM, it smooths out. Like, okay, just wasn't getting enough fuel or something. You know, I wrote it off as just a tough starting engine. Well, that happened on that flight that where I lost the cylinder because the valve failed. And now I won't do that anymore. But there are probably a lot of symptoms like that that we'll go through on future shows and talk about. If you see this, don't fly. If you see this, don't fly. We want to know what those are. And that was one of them. So, yeah.
Well, I am looking forward to your show. I love your show.
Well, I've had emergencies. I'll be talking about that and how to handle them and some philosophies on dealing with things when they go bump in the night.
Tell everybody about your show coming up.
Yeah, so Thursday night, 7 p.m. Central Time. All you've got to do is go to the website, theshiftshow.tv/3. If you want to see all the archives, theshiftshow.tv, and you'll see all of them there. And you can even click on tonight's show on next Thursday to see it live. That's all you've got to do. No registration required. They're good for Wings Credit, and they have basically five segments, every one of them. And we go through those five segments, and we're going to have a lot of fun talking about my emergency that I had with some smoke in the cockpit. And then we'll talk about handling emergencies and some different techniques and tricks that that pilots really should know. So that'll be Thursday night, 7 p.m.
Yeah. Excellent. The Shift Show.
The Shift Show. Yep. It'll be full of Shift. That's for sure. It always is. And, it always is a Shift Show.
I am your biggest fan, my friend. I love that show. It is so wonderfully produced. It really is. Like, you switch screens and you've got great graphics, and it's really quite wonderfully done.
Yeah, you know why it's better? Because we took the production part out of my hands. Let someone else do it. And they're doing a much better job than I am, for sure. So thank you for saying that. I appreciate it. I look forward to you guys. Anybody wants to show up at theshiftshow.tv on Thursday night at 7 p.m. It's the second Thursday of every month is when I'm doing it.
Yeah, I also want to thank Avemco, because they made both that show possible. They help us here at Social Flight. You know, they've spent so much time on safety, and I think that makes a real big difference to everything that we're doing for both of our parts. But yeah, I absolutely love your show. We will be back next Tuesday, March 18th, Social Flight Live. That show, if you go to socialflightlive.com, we'll be here with that show with Commander Willie Driscoll, the first fighter ace of the Vietnam War, who is a truly amazing, spectacular individual. He'll be telling his story, life lessons, things like that. Don't miss that show. That's this coming Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, March 18th. Again, socialflightlive.com. On Tuesday, March 25th, we're going to dive into urban air mobility with Greg Bowles of Joby Aviation. That whole kind of world where we're all going to, be hopping into taxis of the skies in urban areas. And then we are back here on Cockpit to Cal on Tuesday, April 8th. And that's our next show, because we've got Sun and Fun between now and then. And I hope to see some of you at Sun and Fun. I'll be all over the grounds. And most of the time, I'll probably be at one of the booths here on my board from our partners and our sponsors there. So if you hang out at any of theirs or ask about me, if you want to come say hi, I would love to meet any of you in person. And I'll probably have a bunch of swag with me to give away as well.
That's awesome. I don't know how you get all these fantastic guests on your show. You're using some kind of lottery winnings and paying them off or something. But boy, you've got a wonderful lineup. I'm always impressed, and I'm always eager to hear who's going to be on next, because it's got to be a lot of work every week, and then you're finding someone fantastic, and it's chock full of wonderful people. I really appreciate you doing that. It's a lot of fun.
Well, yeah, hey, man, you've been on my show many times.
All these people that matter and me.
Well, thanks to everybody for joining us tonight. It was a lot to pack in here, and apologies, we were like, you know, racing to get all this information out between the two of us. But hopefully we'll get into more of these topics some more in the future. I think autopilots are really, really important, and just do whatever you can to keep them going and stay safe.
Yeah, and watching the links for the email you get, watch for the links for the autopilot SOPs that I've put out, and also for the article that I wrote on automation.
Sounds good. All right. Well, Brian, as always, thank you so, so much for your expertise, your knowledge, your friendship, everything that you do for safety. Thanks to everyone else for joining us here on the show. And I'd just like to wish you all blue skies.
Thank you, everybody. Have a great night.